So this is our current events guy. In the last 2 years, he had to do it from a distance. So we're happy to have Bill with us in the flesh. This is you. This is not a hologram.
It is. Okay. I hope not.
And I'll be sitting over here trying to think of some smarty pants ways to interrupt you.
I'm expecting it.
Okay. But he always starts us off with a overview, as he's a White House correspondent for 17 years.
Going on 19.
19 going on 19 years. You know, he's a credentialed guy that sits in the pool and all of that kind of stuff. Must get cold with the winter that big in that pool, you know.
Yeah, that's the... you have to explain the pool.
Yes, well...
It's the press pool. It's not actually a pool.
Oh, I thought all these years it was a swimming pool that y'all hung out in. Okay.
Look, it didn't take Tommy much time at all. I mean yeah, within the first minute.
Well, I'm a literalist. I don't understand figures of speech, so,
that's
you
right.
know, that's the way it goes. So he's going to give us a biblical world news 365 days a year.
That's right.
Let it rip, Tater Chip.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Tommy. Always a pleasure. Always great to be with you all. And
another great introduction there.
Yeah, it's vintage Tommy. I'm just getting ready for his insight. It'll come soon. But we're living in amazing times, as you all know. And much is happening. And I'm going to do what I can to kind of connect some dots for you tonight. And then any questions you have, I'd be more than happy to answer those. We're living in a time that is so fast and quick. When I first started doing this 23 years ago here in Dallas with Watch.org, we might have four or five biblical events at a time that were happening that were prophetically significant. But today, everything that the Bible speaks of, as far as signs of the end times, they're all in play. And they're now playing off each other, which is very interesting. You know, you have a kind of a picture of what to watch because of God's handbook. But then it's interesting to watch how every one of these areas of focus, 10 or 12 final day events, they all have kind of a life of their own. And it's fascinating. So I'll do what I can to share that for the next hour or so. And then, do the best I can to give you some insight on what we're watching as watchmen for the state of Israel. And then, any questions you have, I'm sure there are a few, about what's taking place in our nation's capital. Also in Israel, and I was telling my wife at dinner tonight, isn't it amazing that three countries that have done more to share the gospel, Israel, or the United States, Britain, and Israel, are going through absolute political chaos. Governmental problems in the UK. And, some incredible theologians came from the UK, Spurgeon and Oswald Chambers and many others. And then look at Israel. They disbanded the Knesset today, and they're going to have an election, in the third election in March. And look what's happening in Washington, D.C. as we speak. So I think there's something biblically significant to that. We had a friend from Belfast, Ireland in last week, and some of the chaos, the political chaos in the U.K. is just unbelievable, as well as our country and Israel. So we're living in days that are exciting. Only God knows how it's going to play out, because it's getting to that point. But anyhow, our website is, for those who aren't familiar with it, is watch.org. 365 days of news a year that's biblically relevant. We focus on biblically relevant news. And Eye to Eye, Facing the Consequences of Dividing Israel, is in its third edition. It covers major events, and now we have all of George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Obama, and Trump administration's first year and a half of office. We have 300 new pages in the book. I've got a few copies here with me. 576 pages from the perfect storm when it was sending 30-foot waves into President George Herbert Walker Bush's home when he was sitting in a podium in Spain calling on Israel to give up their land. 30-foot waves were crashing into his home at the very moment. Not a week later, a month later, a year later. At the moment he's calling for Israel to give up the land they obtained in the Six-Day War, his home had just a little under $1 million worth of damage from the perfect storm. It was called perfect because a lot of events had to happen for the storm to be of that significance. 127 record-setting catastrophes and events that have happened at the time that we were pressuring Israel to divide their land. And the greater the pressure on Israel, the greater the corresponding catastrophe. And, you know, 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Harvey. I'll go into details on that shortly. 12 largest insurance events in U.S. history, 2 largest terrorist events, 14 of the 15 costliest hurricanes, and 5 of the 7 largest tornado outbreaks in U.S. history. You know, you can feel the fire, the fury of the God of Israel when people are talking about creating an Arab state out of Judea, Samaria, and East Jerusalem. You could just feel it. You know, from watching the news, you get in this Holy Spirit, you can just feel when you talk about touching and redividing the land that God gave to the Jewish people, you can feel that fury. Most of these events have happened in America because we've been the sponsor of the peace process. But they've also happened in Europe. And we're also getting ready to put out a video clip on the 10 major events that have happened in Europe when they've kind of taken over while we've had presidential campaigns. When they've been involved, it's happened in Europe. There's something special, as you all know, about that land. And no one has the right to divide or create the boundaries in opposition to the boundaries that God has in Genesis 15:18. Revealed Obama's legacy, being at the White House for 19 years in January, be the official anniversary. I had the 8 years of George W. Bush, which was enjoyable, and then the difficult years of Obama. But this was kind of my catharsis of being able to kind of put into perspective of what I saw. And I've had a couple Christian leaders said, I'm so glad you wrote this, because if you hadn't, we wouldn't have known a lot of these things that have happened. We can read a lot, we can find a lot, but I connected a lot of dots in this book to give you an idea of the depth of what happened during Obama's 8 years in office. And we'll never get over it. I don't see how we'll ever recover from those 8 years. If God brings this nation to its knees, maybe we can get beyond that damage of 8 years. But it's a lot of damage that took place. My opening scripture was Isaiah 5:20. I think that says it best. Woe unto them that call evil good, and good evil, that put darkness for light, and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet, and sweet for bitter. I work with media, 90-95% of the media, that stands for things that are so diametrically opposed to our scriptures. LGBT agenda, same-sex marriage, abortion, even infanticide. Unbelievable. Illegal immigration. On and on. I mean, this is... they completely endorse the platform of the Democratic Party. And I have family members. My mother was very active as a conservative Democrat in Arizona. I have family members that are Democrats. But her party, and she would admit that before she passed, she was not supportive of Hillary Clinton or Obama or what they had done to her political party. And they have moved so far to the left into a position of immorality and an endorsement of immorality and standing publicly priding themselves what they've been able to accomplish. But it's in direct opposition. And I remember being at the White House. I can't believe. I mean, we have all these problems, the United States, all these problems around the world, all these challenges around the world, and they're obsessed with promoting LGBT agenda. Anything that Trump or his administration would do against that agenda or transgenderism in the military, they would be furious. When we have all these issues, they're focused on this. So the book, Who Influenced and Radicalized Obama? I went into a lot of details about that. His white grandfather thought that he needed a mentor. And unfortunately picked Franklin Marshall Davis, a devout communist from Chicago that happened to have a longtime relationship with Valerie Jarrett's family. You look at the twist of how things came together, and unfortunately Franklin Marshall Davis was also a pedophile. And this is who the grandfather selected for a young teenager Barack Obama to be his mentor. And that unfortunately led to a lot of other things. It led to his position, led to his involvement in LGBTQ, same-sex marriage, on and on and on. Saul Alinsky, I mean, isn't it amazing? Supposedly well-meaning issue by his white grandfather led to this happening with Barack Obama, influencing his life to the effect that he influenced our nation and our world. Muslim apologist, Israel's existence in danger, Middle East chaos, these are my chapters, U.S. military's cultural destruction, what he did there, LGBT, he owns it, no one promoted it more worldwide than him, faith on his terms, the convoluted way of looking at Scripture for his benefit, the legacy, will America ever recover? And the final chapter, so help me God understand, so help me God from his perspective, so help me God understand that what I've done, I repent of. It's wrong. It's in opposition to the Scriptures. So it's, we all need to repent. As a nation, we need to repent. The church needs to repent. We all are responsible for this culture that he became president in, and that we couldn't be more effective in standing up against this. So it gives him a chance, personally, to repent and ask for God's forgiveness in the So Help Me God chapter. And then his speeches. I used a lot of his own words. I used a lot of his own words just to, it's kind of almost like a parable to a certain extent, where we see, when you read the own words, I don't have to say anything about those words. We know what they mean in the fact that they're in opposition to God's word. So you don't have to. And I've had even black Christians, black Americans that have come up to me and said, Bill, you really did a good job. You did not have a bone to pick in this book. You presented it the way it was said, spoken, and meant to happen. And that was the purpose. So being there at the White House, I just had to get this out, and that was the purpose of writing the book. Every week we put out a weekly news report on Friday. There's a fair amount of subscribers here, and I thank you for your subscriptions. It's 18 to 20 pages each week of world news that happened that week that was prophetically relevant. It's kind of a summary. It's real tough to keep it at 20 pages with so much going on. And then just kind of a summary of things I'm seeing. Another guy, Jim Fletcher, helps me with what's happening in the church in America, which hard to believe, but it is. Liberalism, it's part of our battle. When I moved to Dallas, from Dallas to D.C. 19 years ago, the person that discipled me and mentored me, he said, Bill, one day our greatest challenge is going to be the other part of the church. We're going to have to, as evangelicals, defend ourselves against them and some of their teachings. And unfortunately, that has become true. And so we write about that, and then we also have a Connect the Dot area, too, that is written by Bill Wilson, who does a great job of issues that are affecting us in our country. So, important read, the next 12 months, all major areas in prophecy are in play. We cross a tipping point, unprecedented record-setting events. We know what to pray about. That's the other importance of our weekly, our daily posting, and also the news report. I came up with Eye of the Hurricane because President Trump has a very unique way of governing. And at the same time, he has a very significant final day role. And I've talked to some of members of his advisory committee, and I say, sure, a lot of what he's doing is a focus on us here in the United States, but he has such a biblically significant final day role. And I'll go into more details. It is incredible. I mean, this 45th president of our country has been compared to Cyrus. And I'll get to that just shortly. But significance of what he's doing biblically and what he's doing with the state of Israel. Became the 45th president when no one thought that was possible. He came from nowhere, ran against 16 qualified Republican candidates. He ran the table in the South that Ted Cruz thought he was going to win because of the evangelicals. He ran the table in the Northeast. He won primary after primary, and everybody, no one thought it was possible. But this is who God wanted to be president, who allowed to be president at the time, just like he allowed Barack Obama to be president, and Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush, and President Trump was his man for the hour. I really appreciate President Trump's reach out to the Evangelical Advisory Council. He likes and appreciates evangelicals. Where George W. Bush was very comfortable with Protestants and Catholics, George, a wonderful man, George Bush, but President Trump has an advisory council. I mean, you recognize a lot of these people here. Tony Perkins, Ralph Reed, Pastor Jeffers here from Dallas, Jack Graham, Mike Evans, Paula White. You know, it's just incredible. Yeah, a lot of these guys, Robert Morris from out here in Southlake, and he listens to him. And when he goes through a very difficult period of time, they come to Washington to be there with him, to pray with him. And, you know, Michelle Bachmann has been very involved, and they just have a great appreciation for him personally. And also, there's Mike Evans with his menorah, presenting it to President Trump for some of the things he's done for Israel. Trump is a leader in an unprecedented time. He's a billionaire deal maker. As of about 12 months ago, 585 billionaires in the United States. That's not a lot of people out of 7 billion people in the world. Got 2,208 worldwide. That's a year-old figure. Probably changed a bit. They're unique people. They have an unconventional style. When I was here in commercial real estate in the Dallas-Fort Worth area for 16, 17 years, I worked with some very wealthy developers. They were unpredictable. You never knew what they were up to. They had the end in sight, and they usually got there. But it was difficult. It was difficult as a real estate broker to deal with people like that because they were so unpredictable. And with Trump and his massive negotiations on trade, you don't know what he's going to do, how he's going to do it, but he also operates extremely well in chaos. And I don't think many of us like having chaos in our lives. I think we like it to be pretty easy and normal and predictable. But he feeds off of it. Unique. Method to madness. There seems to be sometimes it's like, this is just like really crazy. Why is he doing this? Some, you know, he's on the edge sometimes. But he's a disruptor. He's disrupted the swamp in Washington. And as well as those people that want to see Israel give up their land. He's just disruptive there. So anyhow, unprecedented attacks by the media. 91% of our news is negative Trump news. And I have friends, some Jewish friends and other friends. One particular Jewish friend, we're both big baseball fans. We love going to Washington National games. But Steve and I haven't seen each other lately because Steven's gotten so toxic from watching CNN and MSNBC, and he moved from Northern Virginia over right into the heart of the blue state, Bethesda, Maryland, right outside of, and it's just not the same. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Where are you getting your news and how it affects you? And unfortunately, that's the way it is in Washington. 91% of Washington, D.C. voted for Hillary Clinton. 67% in our area, Northern Virginia now, and unfortunately, our state just became a blue state. Unbelievable. I mean, our whole legislature in Virginia now is blue. Even the governor, who is the one pushing infanticide. So, nonetheless, this is a political battle on many different planes. Texas has the Californians. I grew up in Arizona. Arizona is now a blue state. Who would ever thought Barry Goldwater's state would become a blue state? It's the Californians that have moved into Arizona. So, anyhow, what a time we live. Evangelical comfort versus Protestant Catholic. I've been literally in three different places where with President Trump spoken back during the campaign with 1,000 Christian leaders with the Marriott Marquis in New York. You know, Mike Huckabee interviewed him. Franklin Graham was there. Jim Dobson, Tony Perkins, and he just really appreciated our support. And he is a believer. I believe that, but he is a very young believer. But when you look at a young believer, who's he surrounding himself with? That's an evangelical group. That's his group that he surrounds with. And that gives me a level of comfort because the people that are speaking into his life know the gospel. They know the word. You know, many Christian persecutions, I'll get to that, but he's doing a lot in terms of Christian persecution worldwide. He says, why do we give the money to the UN and then have them funneled? Let's just put it where we need. Let's take U.S. taxpayer dollars and put them into the countries that need it directly through Senator Sam Brownback, that through the State Department is putting the funds where they need to be. Mike Pence, wonderful believer. Mike Pompeo, strong believer. Bolden, believer. I don't know a lot about John's background, but strong. He was very. I think he's Protestant, but he was a solid guy and helpful to Trump. And then Sam Brownback loves the Lord, and he's doing some great work. Many accomplishments. This is, you know, his first 2 years. He delivered on a lot of promises. 289 in his first 2 years in office, and a lot more since. His judicial appointments now up to 185 judges. This is huge, because we get killed in the courts all the time as conservatives and as Christians. This is very significant. 185 judges in the federal courts, the circuit courts, district court judges, and two Supreme Court justices. And, you know, bless Mrs. Ginsburg. She's doing everything she can to hang on. I hope she comes to know Jesus as her Lord and Savior. But her motivation to survive right now is so she doesn't give up that seat while Trump's in office, because there's going to be a conservative that might come in that's more conservative than the other two. Gorsuch or Kavanaugh. So a very interesting scenario. And religious freedom commitment. Sam Brownback is the head of the Office of International Religious Freedom, and they're doing great work. Great work. They're having conferences at the State Department. And I'll tell you what, that's a difficult place to operate, the State Department. They are one of the first cabinet seats that got onto LGBT. I couldn't even go. After a while, I couldn't even go there during Obama's time in office. The spirit was so thick in there. But, you know, with Pompeo being the quality believer he is, and Brownback and commitment to this, things have changed a bit. But State Department's a tough place to be. You know, the State Department's the one that told Trump that don't move the embassy, because if you do, it's just everything's going to come unloose in the Middle East. And their former illustrious Secretary of State John Kerry says the whole Middle East is going to catch fire. And of course, as usual, John Kerry was wrong. It didn't happen. What am I watching closely? Trump Middle East deal of the century. I'll go into more details here in just a little bit on that. Putin, Erdogan, and Rouhani are getting closer and closer in their relationship. Trump has pressured NATO. What happens is the people that are part of NATO, 28 countries, they each are supposed to spend 2% of their gross domestic product for defense purposes. And when he took office, only four countries out of 28 were doing it. So when I was at NATO with President Trump and his team in May of 2017, you know, the big thing there, the big celebration was this new $1 billion-plus building that NATO had just built. And Trump, in his style, came in there and immediately, you know, this is supposed to be a celebration of this new $1 billion NATO building. Instead, Trump went in there and he just went on and on about all these countries that are not providing the money. And he ranted and raved and, you know, just, wow, what chutzpah, you know, to do this. But it was necessary. And since then, $130 billion of additional money have been spent by these countries. There are, I think there are 8 to 10 right now of the 28, and the others are getting really close to meeting their NATO requirement. $130 billion in additional money has been spent by these countries to fulfill their NATO requirement because of President Trump.
Is that building up the Antichrist army?
Thanks, Tommy. I'll do that during questions. Yeah, Tommy, you're a couple minutes early. Yeah, that's a good one, Tommy. So anyhow, U.S. trade wars with China and EU. This is an interesting one. The Chinese, a lady that I know with the CIA, 28 years with CIA, says, you know, it's not by chance that the Persians, the Jews, and the Chinese have survived the centuries, because they're that smart. They're very smart people. And, you know, with that said, This Chinese Sun Tzu art of war philosophy is coming up against the Donald J. Trump art of the deal strategy. It's very interesting. Probably one thing I would do differently is not, you know, with his bravado. He and Larry Kudlow, while we're tanking the economy, their Chinese market's crashing. You know, Asia's about face saving. So, you know, if you could frame it a little bit better, that's, you know, he just, this bravado that comes out of the White House sometimes, it's just almost like they can't contain themselves. But they're making headway. And a lot of people are paying the price right now. Farmers and people in the oil business and other industries, economy still doing well, but this is high-level stuff. And I tell you one thing it's done, for those that watch, the Chinese from the think tanks I go to in Washington, D.C., the Chinese were about 5 years away from having their global plan fixed and implemented and in place. And here comes Hurricane Trump. It just, they go like, whoa, what was this? What's that? I mean, how do we deal with this? And it was a plan. It was a global plan. Huawei, you know, moving them into the United States with their 5G networks, where they get access to all our cell phone calls. The Chinese, and I know this from a high-level executive that advises GE and major Fortune 500 companies, that the Chinese are into our power grid. For nefarious purposes. Russians are too, but they want to do it for the sake of, you know, possibly taking down our power grid one day, also a nefarious purpose, but more so about military, where the Chinese are more about stealing trade secrets. And finding out that companies that want to do business in China with that, you know, 1.3 billion people, that's a big market. Unfortunately, you know, they felt this is a way. You know, you want our market. We want to know you. We want your technology. You want to do business with us. We want your patents, and we want to have access to your patents. And unfortunately, it's a pretty bad situation. And our biggest enemy in the world right now is China, without a doubt. And Trump has taken them on. China's everywhere. If I have time, I'll get to it tonight. But China's in everywhere. They're work in Mexico and South America. They're in Spain. They're in Germany. They're in Africa with the rare earth. They're moving into Iraq for the oil. They're looking at the rare earth minerals. I mean, Afghanistan has a couple trillion dollars worth of minerals. It's a very rich country. They're there. They're in Iran. They're down in Venezuela, that has some of the highest oil reserves in the world. They've had a plan, they're strategic, they're patient, and their plans are 50 to 100 years out. Ours are like a couple years, 3 to 5 to 10 at best. So they've had a plan. So this has been this is something the United States needed to do at some point. Unfortunately, we have a media in Washington, D.C. is more obsessed about impeachment than they are about the realities of some of these threats that America faces. And then the Iran conflict, or Trump and the North Korean situation is not getting any better. Unfortunately, the North Korean president used that for photo ops to give him a higher level of proficiency, or not proficiency, but exposure worldwide. And and they were very negative about Secretary Pompeo. All false. And then the Iran conflict. I'll hit on that here in just a little bit. So the good news is Trump's Republican approval is still 85 to 90%. And sometimes it's in 90 up to 93%. You know, he says some things that we just wish he wouldn't say. I had a friend, got together last night with 8 friends of mine that have been friends of mine for 40 years here in Dallas. They all live in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. They've been friends for 40 years. And one of my friends said, Bill, he said, I've got 3 sons in high school. And they ask me sometimes, how do you support somebody like President Trump when he says these things? He said, how should I respond? I said, well, Ted, it's difficult. You have to focus on the good things he does. And then really move your sons and family to pray for President Trump to be a little bit more sensitive sometimes about the things he says. Because we forget that. I hear that from time to time from other friends and other people that says, you know, my children are going, how do you support someone that says these kind of things? And that's part of the other problem with our media. We hear about some of those things, and we don't hear about all the good things that he's doing. And he's doing a lot of great things. So I also suggested emphasizing some of the positive things he's doing and explain to him a certain extent of what he's going through with this impeachment process. His handling of pressure has been pretty extraordinary. I don't think hardly any of us could have handled what he's been through. Difficult situation. Strong economy, record low unemployment for all different ethnic groups. Wage gains. First time we've had a significant wage gain in a long time. I mean, they've got companies that are having difficulty finding employees to fill in this good economy, to fill the jobs. We have a massive federal debt, which still hadn't been dealt with. The hope is the better the economy, the more the taxpayer dollars, the better we'll do against the deficit and reduce it. We're about $23 trillion right now. It's too high. A friend of mine said Democrats like to tax and spend, and Republicans like to borrow and spend. You know, that's pretty astute. So anyhow, the times are good. But at the same time, these are very interesting times, and eventually be consequences. This is an example. When I was looking at Mueller in his testimony, I thought to myself, you know, he just really doesn't look very good. And that afternoon, I saw Trump on the South Lawn speaking to the press, and I'm going, what a picture. Who just went through 2 years of investigations? Mueller. This is the way he looked, bless his soul. Trump, with the pressure he went through, when you put the two pictures together, it's amazing. You'd think that most people had gone through what Trump would have gone through, where they would be more like Mr. Mueller. And so that's extraordinary. And I tell you, President Trump appreciates the prayers. He does. And I tell you, that evangelical group that he surrounds him with, he couldn't have done it without them and without prayer. He knows that. And when he had a difficult time, like I said tonight, they are on a plane to Washington, D.C., and they're in the Oval Office. And that's happened more than a few times. So, the 2020 U.S. elections, well, the deep state's getting exposed, folks. We've been hearing about it, but we're fortunately, thanks to Attorney General Bill Barr and the U.S. Attorney John Durham, President Trump, has put the right people in place. Bill Barr is phenomenal. He was on MSNBC yesterday just all but saying, you know, chastising me. In an interview with Wall Street Journal, he said, we've had a 3-year false narrative, and look what it's done to our country. Look at the division. Look at all the chaos. I'm paraphrasing, but it was, you know, you get a chance, put Bill Barr MSNBC message or Bill Barr Wall Street Journal message with yesterday's date, and it was so spot on. Thankfully, we have a U.S. attorney who loves the Justice Department, who loves our country, who appreciates the FBI, that wants to get things in order. And U.S. Attorney John Durham, he didn't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican. If you're doing it wrong, you're going to pay. We're going to come after you. If he's put in charge of an investigation, he doesn't look at the political party affiliation. He doesn't like it when there is not justice. And he's the one that came out right after Horowitz's report was introduced. He said, you know, we have problems with this. You didn't go far enough, wide enough, and overseas. Bill Barr and John Durham were in the Ukraine. They went to Italy. They've talked to people face to face. They want to get to the bottom of this. And they don't want it to happen again. So, you know, pray for Bill Barr. Pray for John Durham that will get behind this and get the truth out. This is, you know, it's a battle of good and evil. And my wife emphasizes to me, she said, Claudia said, a large part of President Trump's warfare, the warfare that's against President Trump is because of him standing for Israel. And that's probably the number one thing. By his things he's done for Israel, which I'll go here through shortly, by him standing for Israel, he has been under massive spiritual warfare, number one, because of that reason. Because of what he's done. He has been in direct opposition with the evil forces of the world, the evil forces in the Middle East, the evil forces within the EU and Russia, because he has stood up against them and hasn't varied. We've never had a president supportive of Israel. U.S. media bias, we all know that. It's terrible. Not much we can do about it. I mean, it's the way it is, 90-95%. Unfortunately, Fox is changing. Rupert Murdoch's in his final couple years. He's preoccupied now. And his sons are pretty more liberal. And Fox is changing, and more pro-LGBT people are being put into Fox. They're sliding on some things. It's changing. I mean, that was one of our... We're still getting some good news out of some of their conservatives, but it's getting more and more difficult there, and it's going to get watered down even more because of Murdoch's sons. So it has a huge factor on people's influence and what they see as truth. Democratic primaries, there's really nobody that can beat Trump. I mean, it's a very weak bench. And that's another reason the Democrats are doing what they are right now with this impeachment stuff, because they don't have anybody to beat Trump. And this is the motivation. My concern is we've got 41 Republicans in 2018 during the midterm election that didn't rerun. And we lost some good folks. I don't know how many of those seats were actually filled by Republican, but they were all seasoned Republicans that just said, you know, I've had enough of this. Or we've had enough of this. Now we have 19 that are not running in the 2020 election, and 5 here in Texas. So that's a concern. They're just fed up with this. But you know, if they're not there to help defend, I mean, I don't know who will, because it could get worse. And then Russia and Ukraine have been distractions. You imagine the leaders of Russia, or leader of Russia and his people, looking. You might not have got the election, but look what you've helped create. You know, and the Democratic Party has been there to help create this fiasco that we've witnessed for the last 3-plus years. And then foreign policy. President Trump's foreign policies, unique. The trade policies, the NATO policies, his staunch support of Israel, that's disrupted the international order. Another component of spiritual warfare. But Trump and Israel, you know, when he first got elected, people were saying, started comparing to King Cyrus. They were saying 45th president, we got Isaiah 45. Well, there's a coin in Israel with Trump and Cyrus, and it's distributed to Israel. And, you know, here's Isaiah 44:28. That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built into the temple, thy foundation shall be laid. King Cyrus said, move out of Babylon, you can go back to Israel. You can go back to Jerusalem from Babylon, and it had a very significant role. And Isaiah 45, thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the 2-leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut. Go back, people of, go back, Jewish people, go back, people of Zion, go back to Israel. And I'll touch on this briefly. This is kind of an eye-to-eye component. 2004 and 2005 were very difficult years as far as the major hurricanes, the catastrophes that were happening at the time. The Bush administration was very active in the peace process. 2004, Charlie, Jean, Francis, and Ivan were all big, huge, record-setting hurricanes. And then 2005, Katrina, Rita, Wilma, and Dennis. Katrina began within a couple hours of President Bush being congratulating Ariel Sharon for moving out of the settlements. 9,500 Jews were ripped from their homes in 24 settlements in Gush Katif, which is in Gaza, in Samaria. And within a couple hours, this storm out of nowhere near the Bahamas just developed into this monster storm. And one thing that they have in common is that they all occurred during active, very active peace efforts. George W. Bush was promoting the 2 states for 2 peoples in 2004 and 2005, and President Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, the deal of the century in 2017 and 2018. And, you know, I'd written President Trump and his top 6 people and delivered eye-to-eye, just like I did when President Bush was in office. And warned them, don't touch the land. And as much as President Trump is a friend of Israel, the deal of the century has to do with Judea, Samaria, and Jerusalem. And we had, the Trump Middle East peace plan. They had meetings in Israel. But what happened is at that time, this meeting here, August 24th, is the day that Hurricane Harvey regathered. For 3.5 days, this little storm off the Gulf Coast, off of Corpus Christi and out in the Gulf of Mexico, it was history. This storm just was really never even developed. But all of a sudden, Kushner arrives in Jerusalem, and Harvey literally developed instantaneously within 24 hours, became a massive rain producer. For, you know, Frank and others that lived in Houston that experienced the floods. And I thought, wow, this is, you know, I'm just finishing the update of my book. And I contacted my printer. I said, I need the weekend. I know you got a tight schedule. Give me till Monday. This is Friday. I said, I got to do some research on what was going on, what was taking place. And I go, you know, what was the administration doing at the time? And I couldn't come up with anything. I said, okay, where was Kushner? Nothing here. Well, I started reading the Arab press. And I was real familiar with it because I went with President George Bush to the Middle East in 2008. I've been to most of these countries in the Middle East with him, key countries on the Persian Gulf. And sure enough, Kushner was in Doha, Qatar. Kushner was in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. He was in, then he went to Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. And then from there he went to Jordan and Egypt. But it was all secretive. And the CBS finally got a hold of the White House and says, where's Kushner been? They said, well, we can't tell you. We don't have any information. They contacted the Secret Service. Where was Kushner? So it was confirmed that he was in those countries meeting with those leaders on the deal of the century. And what Israel was going to do is give up Judea, Samaria, and Jerusalem in a trade for normalization of relationships with the state of Israel. For the sake of Israel, for the sake of them. And sure enough, unbelievable. And then shortly thereafter, Trump was getting ready for, and this all happened during the month of Elul. Elul is a month of repentance and preparation for the high holy days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. This year's Elul had 3 record-setting Category 4 hurricanes that hit hard. 2 U.S. states and U.S. territory during the Trump administration's extensive Middle East talks pertaining to Israel's land. You had 3 historical record-setting hurricanes, and that was Harvey, Irma, Marie. Irma developed as his administration was preparing for U.N. meetings when President Trump was going to sit down with Netanyahu, Abbas, Abdullah, and also El-Sisi at the UN. And Irma, these were record-setting. I mean, these were some of the biggest, most violent storms in the Atlantic history. And thanks to the prayer of the saints and people in Florida, they were praying, Lord, please, because it was heading right at Miami. And if it hit Miami, it would have been even much bigger than even Katrina. And fortunately, it started moving its way to the west. And just went up the Gulf Coast, western part of Florida. But they were all preparing for this really important meeting at the UN. September 18, President Trump meets with Netanyahu. Hurricane Marie went from a Category 1 to a Category 5 within 14 hours. It's like, just doesn't happen like this. And he's telling Netanyahu, you need to meet with El-Sisi. You need to work with him closely because we need to move in. We need a comprehensive peace plan, and we need Egypt involved with this. So within the next 24 hours, Netanyahu met with El-Sisi. And then the following day, September 20, at the very moment President Trump is meeting at the UN with Abbas, Abdullah, and El-Sisi, Marie sits in Puerto Rico. The very moment. And very violent storm. You know, I have friends that have lived through these. It's so difficult to explain. I've seen it over and over again. I watched the pattern. The greater the pressure, the greater corresponding catastrophe. But it happens. There's something about that covenant land. And then Trump's meetings was over, Marie moved off, and that was it. So you had $250 billion plus in damages in mass dislocation. We've had almost $1 trillion in hurricanes that have a connection to the state of Israel. And then Hurricanes Florence and Michael, 2 historical record-setting hurricanes. and over $100 billion plus in damages. Florence and Michael, September, October 2018, over $100 billion plus in damages. We must continue to pray for those impacted by these storms. And these five hurricanes, Harvey, Irma, Marie, Florence, and Michael, have had their names retired due to size and cost during Trump's first 2 years. They were so big. I've been sending things to the White House, sending books to the White House. And then I got to Michelle Bachmann said, Bill, I've got a meeting at the State Department. This was in February with Secretary Pompeo, who was a good friend of Michelle's from their time in Congress together. Kushner was going to be there. Greenblatt was going to be there. Other members of the advisory committee, Pastor Jeffers, Pastor Jack Graham was there, and numerous other people were in the meeting. And Michelle submitted my book, Eye to Eye, to Pompeo, Kushner, and Greenblatt. And Mike Pompeo said to Michelle, I hear you. I hear you, Michelle. I hear you. Michelle's tenacious. But I met with them right afterwards at the Trump International Hotel. And they all said Michelle just did a fantastic job of really speaking about the consequences and possibly the possibility of President Trump's reelection if he does the wrong thing. And Dr. Kaiser hit it right on today. Our blessing right now, the reason we're still standing here in America is because of this president's support of the state of Israel. We've never had a president even close to being as supportive of the state of Israel as he has been. So we made headway, and fortunately, the plan has not been submitted. It's been delayed. Even the Bahrain conference, which was an economic conference that was held, was put aside because of the influence of the lobbying effect. I mean, we care about our country. We care about those people in harm's way. We also want to make sure we're on the right side of this. As you all know, Jerusalem is God's time clock. Pastor Criswell used to say at First Baptist, you want to know where things stand biblically and prophetically, watch what's happening with the city of Jerusalem, God's time clock. And it shall be in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. The only major country right now that's standing for Israel, standing for Jerusalem, is the United States. We have some smaller companies, Guatemala. Others are considering Brazil, Australia, but Brazil's concerned. There's a lot of halal meat that goes to the Arabs, $1 billion, so they've been able to stop Brazil's moving of the embassy to Jerusalem. But, you know, it's all political. But nonetheless, no country like the United States when it comes to or this president. Trump was with Netanyahu May 23rd, 2017. I was there for their first meeting. Quite a meeting. Trump's Middle East Dream Team, Pence, David Friedman, who spoke to Christian leaders in Washington right after he became the ambassador, and a lot of the Jewish groups. The Jewish groups, 20% of Jews are Orthodox, that they're very fundamental in their faith, like we are with our faith, evangelicals. 80% are Reform and Conservative and tend to be liberal. And they were opposing Friedman's selection. And this is a man that knows Hebrew, who gives money to the settlement community, who sat with some friends of mine in January of 2017. We were in San Diego speaking at a conference, and 35 friends of mine, people that I know, he sat down and went right through the Old Testament, the Tanakh, talking about Israel's biblical right to the land. This is Trump's ambassador to Israel. And he wants to see Israel live in peace, but he fully understands Israel's biblical right to the land. Trump's Middle East Dream Team at the time. This was the Dream Team. Mattis, a warrior. He understood the Middle East. They had some differences, and they had some differences over Israel, but eventually he moved on. Pompeo, oh, what a blessing he's been. Nikki Haley, oh, can you imagine the job that she did as U.N. ambassador? Remarkable. Right in the teeth of that UN that constantly fulfills or passes resolution that are anti-Israel. When many members of the UN, anti-Semitic, hate Israel, they're constantly voting on resolutions against Israel. When you have all these nations that have very significant problems, you hardly ever hear a resolution about, whether it's Iran and others. You just don't hear it. And John Bolton, he tells it like it is. He sees things so clearly, and at times it, you know, rubbed the president wrong. But the president will remember John Bolton's position on some things, because he was he's always been succinct and very direct about what he has to say. Trump committed to moving the U.S. Embassy December 6, 2017. This is interesting. This is 6 months to the day that the first ever Jerusalem prayer breakfast began. It was in that period of June 5 and 6 in Jerusalem. 6 months to the day they moved the embassy. President Trump finally signed off moving the embassy to Jerusalem. Trump withdrew Iran from the Iran nuclear deal, May 2018. A terrible deal. U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem opens May 14, 2018. Trump two-state plan, he spoke of that with Netanyahu at the UN again in 2018. But he says, I like the two-state solution, but he says it's up to Israel. Well, right now, President Trump, they are not, if a plan gets delivered, you know, it's up to the Lord if it does get delivered, but they are not going to put two-state in there. They will not. It's not going to happen. And I'll get to that just shortly here. Trump formally recognizes Israel's control of the Golan Heights. This is huge. I remember in early 2016, Obama's last year in office, when Israel, Netanyahu brought his whole cabinet up to the Golan. And they at that time acknowledged that Israel has the right to the Golan Heights. They'd already annexed it. This was their property. Within minutes, the EU, the UN, and then within a day, Russia, the United States chastised Netanyahu, saying, how dare you say that? You don't have the right to the Golan Heights. That's part of UN Resolution 238. You can't stand for that. That is not yours. It's serious. I mean, this is big news. Trump said, heck with that. We're going to back Israel's right to the Golan Heights. Quick note here. It's very interesting. When Mike Pompeo was at the at West Point, top of his class, he studied the tank wars. He became a tank commander. One of the main wars that he studied at West Point was the Yom Kippur War and Israel's capturing of the Golan Heights with the use of tanks. And 4 years ago, it was 2015, I was with three leaders of Samaria. We went up to meet with 20 congressmen and a couple senators. And right after we walk into Mike Pompeo's office, the first thing he said to these leaders of Samaria, well, I'm so glad you didn't give up the Golan Heights. And as right at the time, Netanyahu was negotiating with Erdogan from Turkey and Assad on giving up some of the Golan. And now he's the opportunity to be Secretary of State and to stand for the Golan Heights and also for the Israel's right to say that those settlements are not illegal. So anyhow, that very significant move. Trump Heights, now we have Israel invades Trump Heights settlement. There's a community up there. I mean, there's going to be a community called Trump Heights. It's incredible. And then, and this is another one of those things, this is like a little rock out in front of the Mamilla Hotel. For all of President George W. Bush's effort, and the 24 trips that Condoleezza Rice took to Israel in the second term of President Bush, who birthed the word two states living side by side in peace and security, the 9/11 terror events stopped from being presented the first time. But this is his acknowledgement in Israel. They like President Bush, but this is what they thank him. A little rock out in front of the Mamilla Hotel. Just so interesting. Peace to Prosperity Workshop. This is where they divided the economic from the land, and I think that lobbying had an influence in this. And then Pompeo says Israel's settlements not illegal. This was huge. Very significant, because everybody, or the major powers, the EU and others, said before that they're illegal, and after they said it's illegal. Didn't bother President Trump and Mike Pompeo. And the State Department took a year studying this whole process. Legally, they looked at every aspect of this, and they said, this is not illegal for what Israel's done here. It was a tedious process. It wasn't just like, okay, we're going to go say this. They looked into it. And plus Pompeo being a Harvard law graduate, I mean, he knows the law, and they did it very smartly. But then the U.S. House passed last Friday a resolution supporting the two states because of what Trump and Pompeo did. They said, no, no, we still favor two states. I have some friends with Messianic Jewish Alliance, Joel Chernoff, Paul Lieberman, and their lobbyists were working real hard on the one state plan in Congress. And I told them, guys, you're going to have your hands full. You got to focus on the Democrats. Republicans are going to go with you. You got to focus on the Democrats. And then I popped an email. They just were amazed that the Democrats did this. But it was because of what Trump and Pompeo did. They didn't want to give Trump any kind of victory here. Trump, and then today, another bold thing for the Jewish community and in Israel. Trump signs executive order to crack down on anti-Semitism on college campuses. This is huge because most of the Middle East departments in the college campuses around the country are funded by the Saudis. And there are a lot of schools in the country that are, Jewish people can't wear their kippahs. They feel threatened. But this is huge. This is another strong stance of this president for Jewish people. I'm going to go through a couple of slides here, and then I'll work into the Russia, China, and Iran. Hit on those because these are very, very important. About a month ago, we were at the Christian Media Summit. This is put on by the Israeli Press Office. They bring media from all over the world that are supportive of Israel in for a conference. They've done it for 3 years. We've been there two of the last three. And Benjamin Netanyahu spoke to us the first night. From my camera, I had a chance to shake his hand and his wife's right after that. Very gracious people. And he's got his challenges, no doubt, as well. And then David Friedman gave a great message in appreciation of the Christians that had come in from around the world. And then we went to the Golan Heights for a briefing. This was on what Israel's doing with the fact now under the nose of the UN there's 120,000 rockets pointed at Israel. This is under the nose of the UN peacekeepers since 2006. But they have some electronics. Their tanks are impenetrable. They got the best in the world. They have everything set up on a grid up there. I mean, anytime anything happens up there, I mean, they're warned. God's giving them technology that's extraordinary. They were telling us about where all the rockets are placed in this one area. He said they're three-story homes. They got the rockets in the middle part of the houses. We're going to have to take them out. They know what's going on. It's like what King Hussein said after the Six-Day War. He said, the Arabs have 34 bases in the Middle East. Israel knows more about them in times of operation, what's there, than we do ourselves. But when you're a tiny little country like Israel that has neighbors and want to destroy them, they've got to be like that. And then this is me at the Trump. It was just quite an enjoyable day being there at the site of this. And then President Rivlin, a wonderful man, he's up there shaking a couple of friends of mine's hands there at the president's house. And then here's Claudia doing what she loves doing the most, talking to soldiers about Jesus. And I don't know, when Claudia starts talking about Jesus, they listen. It's something to watch. And talks to you about what happens when you're in harm's way. It all depends. Every time is different as the Holy Spirit leads. Who are you going to call on when you're in harm's way? A lot of times they say Moses. And Claudia starts saying, let me tell you about somebody who really loves you. And she starts talking about Yeshua. So this was a fun time. And then this is one of the managers at the Orient Hotel. I shared this today with some of the speakers at lunch. The Jerusalem Prayer Breakfast, which was June of last year, Ann Graham Lotz spoke at the hotel at the Orient and also at the Knesset. And she started talking about Jesus. Well, this gentleman started tearing up. And another one of the Arabs that was also one of the managers in the hotel started tearing up over what Ann was saying. And Ann heard about this, and Ann was leaving to come back to the U.S., and Ann said, Claudia, would you follow up with these two guys? So Claudia went in and shared the gospel with Jason here and Ibrahim, and they both gave their life to Jesus. And when we were going on this trip, Claudia said, "Ann, I'm going to take Jesus and Me, your new book. Could you sign a note?" She did. And this is Jason's appreciation of Ann and the book that she just received. And during the Christian Media Summit, which is also at the Orient, we have two other managers that have now given their life to Jesus. So the Orient Hotel in Jerusalem has four believers in Yeshua now. So praise God for that. Tommy, how much? Tom, I'm going to run through some things. Okay, all right, brother. The conflict in the Middle East, it's pretty complicated. And the big thing in the Middle East is one of the greatest conflicts is the Shiites versus the Sunnis. And we've got the Shiites led by Iran, which is antagonistic towards Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia worries about Iran becoming nuclear because they're going to be the second one hit after Israel. Well, I'll tell you what, Saudi Arabia, Iran would be as interested in taking out Saudi Arabia as they would be Israel. And they don't. The blood is bad over who has the lineage to Muhammad. And Iran has proxies in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen. These are all majority Shiite countries. And the challenge here is these countries are all beginning to bring weapons in. Some new, some later, such as in Syria, that are going to point rockets at Israel. Iraq, they're bringing missiles into Iraq right now pointed at Israel. Iran's going to be bringing weapons that have been, the Houthis there, that have been pointing at Saudi Arabia, are going to start pointing at Israel. So Israel knows about this. They've got their eye on this, but they're talking. Iran keeps getting smacked by Israel inside of Syria. Israel goes in and takes out their new missile shipments. Missiles are more concerned than rockets. And one of our top generals said the other day, Iran has the most advanced missiles in the Middle East and the most of them, even more than the European Union. And they popped a couple of missiles into the Saudi refineries. It was a miracle. It could have been much worse and crippled the economy of the world because 25% of the daily oil goes through the Persian Gulf. Iranians are strategic and they got a plan. And then a journalist from Saudi Arabia said to me, he says, "Bill, the Sunnis play checkers, the Persians play chess. Three-dimensional chess. They're so smart. They're so patient. They've got a strategy." And then you have the Persian Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Oman, Bahrain, and Qatar, that are all on the Persian Gulf. And 80% of the Muslims are Sunnis. So this is a very significant conflict. And here's the Shia versus Sunni countries. Iran, is a significant property. And then Iraq. Well, these are two large oil producers in the world. Now I'll have more on that shortly. Trump and King Salman. Jared Kushner said, let's go into Saudi Arabia first. This will be the first foreign visit. And he set up a meeting where President Trump had the opportunity to speak to 55 Muslim leaders. Trump spoke to these leaders, which was, unheard of, where we have an American president says, "Okay, I'm coming to Riyadh, and I want to speak to you guys. And if you're friends of us and put down your terrorism weapons, you got a great friend. If you don't, then you're an enemy of us." And he told them that. And in Trump style. And then Salman and Kushner developed a close relationship where they stay up numerous times overnight, swapping stories and planning strategy on the deal of the century. Iran's Khamenei attacks Trump's nuclear deal decision. He decided to get out of it. After the deal, a new Iranian strategy was presented by Mike Pompeo at the Heritage Foundation. 12 things the Iranians need to do. And they probably won't do any more than a couple things, if that. The main thing is that for them to stop the missile development. And Iran's committed to that. And the Iran nuclear deal that Obama and the G5 plus one, Russia, China, Germany, France, and the UK, and the United States plan, gave Iran, after a few years, a couple more years, to be able to develop nuclear weapons. What kind of plan is that? Just postponement. U.S. decided to leave the Human Rights Council, a cesspool of political bias. This was a very significant move. Then the Iranian leader Khamenei, strategic and patient. They're chess players, the Iranians. They're master negotiators. I have a friend at the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. He's now in the U.K. He said, Bill, you can't out-negotiate an Iranian. They're masters at negotiations. They'll agree to a deal, and then a few years later negotiate the same deal with less teeth in it. They're masters. They get PhDs. An Iranian guy in D.C. told us they get PhDs in negotiations. They'll drive you crazy. And they have their proxies. And they're also working right now to get into Sudan and Libya. This is part of the coalition of nations in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Deploy missiles in those countries. More missiles in the Middle East and even more than the EU. I mentioned that already. And U.S. sanctions have been very costly to that country. The sanctions were hurting during Obama's time. The sanctions were put in place were hurting Iran. But then right at the time of breaking, the lifeline was thrown and they cut the nuclear deal because Obama didn't have any legacy from all his efforts in the Middle East. And then obviously a threat to the Persian Gulf. And Iran's also doing a Red Sea play. They're really focused on this Red Sea access and access of the Red Sea, which is also another area where we bring oil and oil through, and then also the Persian Gulf. U.S. is pressing allies to stop Iranian purchases. They did in November and gave them a little bit more time, but now it is really hurting their economy. President Rouhani makes veiled threats about disrupting oil by shutting the Strait of Hormuz. General Soleimani supports actions. Soleimani, he's just missed a couple assassination attempts. He's the head of their Al-Quds force and a very dangerous guy. Iran's hardliners support Rouhani's pushback against the United States. You see the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf here. You know, those two checkpoints where you see the blue marks, that's what they want to do. Iranian strategic, very clever. If they can shut those two, they could literally bring those access points to oil. They could literally bring the world economies to their knees. I mean, look what happened in July of 2008 when oil hit $147 a barrel. Crippled two of our major oil companies, corporations were going bankrupt. And if they can stop the oil through those two, it could be catastrophic. Mark Langford, a friend of mine, is a Jewish attorney from Manhattan. He does maps that focus. He's the head of Americans for a Safe Israel. And he calls this black gold, the Persian Gulf, Strait of Hormuz. 56% of the world's proven oil and gas is in that quadrant there. Iraq, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, part of Oman, Bahrain. Doesn't have much oil, and then Iran. So they can control this, which they have the missile capability now that they can control this. But and I think they're, one of our top generals the other day who handles the Middle East said he would not be surprised if Iran doesn't attack again soon. Top Iranian General Hossein Salami, forces in Syria awaiting orders to destroy Israel. Bolton threatens Iranian generals, we'll come after you. This was last year in September. This was at the United Against Nuclear Iran Summit in New York. Iran and Hezbollah prepare to confront Israel in response to its actions in Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. Concern lately is, matter of fact, this week, some Russian jets kind of moved a couple of the Israeli jets off target. They were going into Syria to take out some more missile movements, and Russia Su-35s kind of shoved the Israeli jets back out the ocean, and found out later it was cover for Iranians moving some new missiles into Syria. So I'll talk about that shortly. Jeremiah 49, 35 through 39 talks about the day that the bow of Elam will be busted, or will be broken. Elam is modern-day Persia. Modern-day Persia is Elam. And here it highlighted, for I will cause Elam to be dismayed before their enemies. I will bring evil upon them, even my fierce anger, saith the Lord. And I will set my throne on Elam. But it shall come to pass the latter days that I will bring against the captivity of Elam, saith the Lord. Some people believe that this will be fulfilled. Some people say it's never been fulfilled. Some people say it has. But the bottom line is the gospel is being shared throughout Iran right now. Many people are coming to Christ in Iran. Through Iran Live, it's headquartered here in Dallas. We have some other friends who are doing ministry work in Iran. So there's this scripture sounds like Iran's, even before the Ezekiel 38-39 conflict, will have a devastated hit. So will it be Israel, the United States? Israel's got a plan. Believe me, now with the stealth, they got a plan. If they get smacked, they're going to smack Iran. And they might even have to do it first, which they almost did in 2008 when Obama was in office. So, U.S. and Russia, this relationship is difficult for many reasons, and we'll go into that. But the main concern ours is the rapid movement of Russia into the Middle East. I mean, they are really moving in quickly. They're in Syria. That's their beachhead. They have a port in Tartus, Syria. They're selling S-400 weapons to Turkey, despite NATO, despite the United States says don't do it. The only good thing that came from that is we're not going to send Turkey some of our F-35 stealth jets that they were buying. The interesting aspect of this, part of the stealth, the F-35, is made in Turkey. And so right now the Pentagon is ready to, it's going to cost about $500 million to move that facility out of there, but they're going to be building parts of the F-35 in other places besides Turkey. The other problem is the United States has a base there in Turkey, about 2,000 troops, but we also have up to 50 nuclear weapons at that Turkish base, which is also complicates things. And also, you know, when Turkey or when Trump moved some people out of the Kurdish area, or boots in the ground, the Kurds there in Syria, he was absolutely surprised by the backlash from Christians that love the Kurds. And this is a PKK part of the Kurds. This is more of the terroristic, difficult, not the Peshmerga Kurds of northern Iraq. This is these are Kurds that basically were our boots in the ground that did a great job against ISIS. They are the best fighters in the Middle East. And then to throw them under the bus, but I can tell you, I know people, and you know people, that flock into the White House quickly after this. Franklin Graham and others, Pastor Jeffers, others spoke out that, you know, these are our Kurds, these are our friends. We've got to do something about this. So anyhow, things have calmed down a bit, but that was a difficult situation. I mentioned the Su-35 deflected Israeli jets this week. They're moving their way. They're doing just the other day, Russia's talking with Egypt about buying jets right now. The United States says, stop it. Stop it. If you buy those jets, we're going to shut off. We're talking about shutting off funding to you guys. So that's very tentative. Saudi Arabia, they're supposedly going to develop some nuclear facilities for Saudi Arabia. They're doing a lot of oil deals there. They're part of OPEC Plus now. And they're helping build a nuclear facility in Turkey as well. And they're moving into the region more so than ever before. See, Ariel Sharon pushed the importance of an Israeli relationship. He did a lot to develop a relationship with Putin. Netanyahu continued that. Olmert didn't, but Netanyahu has. And unfortunately, Israel and Russia are sharing a lot of things in technology, science, oil and gas. And we're getting a little nervous. But, you know, they're trying to keep the big bear happy. And, eventually that won't work out too well for them. Russia's using their very sophisticated social network people, focusing on the young Sunnis, developing a favorable relationship with them about Russia, and they're doing it masterfully. And so more and more of the young, the Middle East is full of 30-40%, 30 and under kids. I think Iran, I heard it's almost 50% in Iran are under 30. So Russia, very smart people too, are appealing to the social networks, to the Arabs, the Sunnis, and even the Shiite for a favorable look to them, or for them to be favored, and also exploiting President Trump's desire to exit the Middle East. And we're not completely out of there. We understand the importance of being there, but President Trump has really expressed, we've already spent $5-6 trillion in the Middle East, and a lot of loss of life and a lot of injuries. We need to do something. 700 Russian people and companies are under U.S. sanctions. What's also interesting is Russia bombers continue to come near our shore with fighter jets, and they have to be scrambled. Also, the Russia's 300 S-300s in Syria. Israel will have to think twice about the next strike. Now they have the S-400C, more sophisticated. Israel's figured out how to beat the S-300, but now they're working on trying to beat the S-400 system. They beat the 300 by doing Mediterranean exercises. So, you know, God always gives them a step ahead of the enemy. Top U.S. admiral warns of Russia's submarine threat. We've had Russian subs on our coast over a few times, very close to the United States. So they're kind of playing with us a bit. And there was a Russian sub accident recently, and one of the pretty well-qualified stories, even beyond a rumor, was that the Russian sub was attempting to cut internet phone lines that come from Europe to the United States, and ended up having an accident and losing some of their soldiers. So, you know, Russia's nipping at us. And also, you know, if put yourself in your in their shoes, you got all your friends. Putin's friends have all been sanctioned, and his country's been sanctioned, and it's cost them. So what are they going to do? At some point, they're going to respond. So it's a very difficult world that we live in on the international front. And then Lavrov rejected Israel's sovereignty in the Golan in October 12. He was at the White House yesterday, a meeting with Trump. And I don't know, I have all the details of that meeting yet, but you know, Russia was furious by that situation because it's right there in the border of Syria. That's very valuable land. U.S. pulls out a Reagan-era arms treaty, saying Russia made no efforts to comply. But isn't it interesting? The Gog and Magog alignment, Trump has sanctioned Russia, Iran, and Turkey strongly. Turkey, there's still some sanctions on Turkey, but the bulk of the strong ones have been against Russia and Iran. And this has driven these three guys closer together. Rouhani, Putin, and Erdogan. Another meeting in Tehran. And then another one recently in Sochi. I think this is the one in Sochi, Russia. And then the Russian Navy celebrates Navy Day with a parade in Tartus, Syria. A quick one over, on China. What really concerns the United States, and Israel should be concerned too, is China has gained control of the Haifa port. They're spending a few billion dollars to construct the port. And the United States says, you got to stop that because we're not putting our 6th fleet in there again. They've done that before, come into the... He said, you better stop that. You got to stop that arrangement. China has spent $25 billion in Israel. They're buying all kinds of companies. They bought the largest dairy producer in Israel because Israeli cows produce more milk per cow than any other dairy companies in the world. Agriculture, science, medicine, technology, China's in there buying stuff up. And the United States says, you better get accountable. We want accountability. So Israel's now got a group that's been, Netanyahu's put in place, that they're going to fully investigate all business that China's doing with Israel and review it. Oil deals with Saudi Arabia and Iran and Iraq. China is doing big deals with Saudi Arabia. At one time, they might still be the largest buyer of oil from Saudi Arabia. They've done joint oil deals in Iran. They've put those on hold because of sanctions. And also, they and Russia have become major players in Iraq's oil fields, which is one of the top four in the world. We spent all that money. We've got a couple of U.S. companies in there. But we've got China and Russia that are gaining a lot of money from doing oil deals inside of Iraq. And also mentioned earlier, they penetrated our U.S. power grid and stolen technology. And, you know, we talk about the Bible. We say the 200 million man army one day will have it. The Bible speaks of that. Some people believe that's China. A few years back, I looked at the CIA fact book, and at that time, China could put an army together of 196 million people. if needed to be. And we've been close a couple times with a military conflict with China over Taiwan and a Japanese island. And also recently, Congress kind of forced Trump's hand on Hong Kong. I mean, something needed to be done, but right in the middle of tight negotiations, they pass on almost a unanimous resolution backing Hong Kong's right to independence. And it infuriated China, and China says, we're not going to allow your ships anymore to come into Hong Kong for refueling. And then China's worked its way into South America. They're a major player with Venezuela's oil, along with Russia, Panama Canal. They control a Chinese company controls that. And in Africa, they're after their rare earth minerals. And just finish with these. Defense Secretary Mattis, when he was in office, warned of Chinese intimidation in the South China Sea, and that there would be reprisals. And also, when you talk about China's moving into all these countries around the world, they also, with this recent Hurricane Dorian, Marsh Harbor port in Abaco Island, which is right there in the Bahamas, China was just completing a $40 million port in Marsh Harbor. And the United States Coast Guard says you're not meeting the qualifications. So we're not going to allow any of our ships to come in there. But our great concern was that this fentanyl that's working its way into the United States, that's destroying a lot of our young people, would possibly be coming. This would be one of the locations that would come in besides Mexico. And literally, this port was within a very short period of time of being completed. And Dorian was a unique hurricane because it literally came in and sat on the Bahamas. Usually it keeps moving on, but it sat. I said, there's something really strange about this. Trump was real involved with Greenblatt at the time of the hurricane. And I'll give more details just briefly. But this literally sat on Abaco Island and wiped this port out completely. And then it moved. Then it also destroyed the Grand Bahama Airport, which was owned by Chinese Hutchison Port Holdings out of Hong Kong. And then Freeport Harbor is also owned by the Chinese. So this is one of those, and also there's Grand Bahamas is a very significant gambling place. It's 15, 20 casinos. Many of those were wiped. So quick note here just to complete it. Dorian started heading right after sitting on the Bahamas, was heading right towards Mar-a-Lago, Trump's home. And Greenblatt and Trump were talking about a peace deal, possibly even delivering it right before the Israeli election to help Netanyahu. Netanyahu said it possibly is going to happen for the second election, September 17th. And at the last minute, Greenblatt says, no, we're not going to deliver it. For whatever reason, he just said, we're not going to deliver it before the election. We're going to wait till the government gets seated. Dorian started working its way up north, went up the coast. What was also interesting, it came out, Governor DeSantis from Florida had put a note in the Western Wall in Israel asking God to spare the state from storms in May of this year. And it come to find out, I did some more homework and found out that Governor Crist had done the same thing beginning in 2007. He'd done the same thing after Florida was hit so hard in 2004 and 2005 by hurricanes. 2006, when Trump said, I'm not going to pressure Israel to give up their land, nothing happened in 2006. But he put something in the wall in 2007 to spare the state, and every year up until the time he left office and even went into Congress, a note was put in the wall every single year. And the last one he put in the wall was in 2016 when he was a congressman in Jerusalem. Spare our state. And then DeSantis picked up on this in May. 2017, Hurricane Michael hit Florida hard. Best we know, there wasn't any covering. I don't know. It's just really interesting. You have all those years, no hurricane. of any significance hit Florida, except for 17 when Michael came ashore. Irma skipped up the coast. And then, so we've contacted a friend of mine who's a friend of the governor's of South Carolina. I know it's gone on the wall for South Carolina. Another friend that was with Lieutenant Governor of North Carolina just recently, he put a note in the wall for North Carolina. And also, I put a wall in, a note in the wall for Texas a month ago. So we'll see what happens. But anyhow, I thought that was an interesting note. So anyhow, I'd be more than happy to take some questions. I covered a lot of territory tonight, but obviously there's a lot going on. So please, whatever, the Washington thing, so whatever I can answer. What's that? Well, about the impeachment?
Yeah, we're going to have question and answers. We're going to take a... Are you finished?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a 10-minute break. We can start with Charlie.
Okay. Mic on? Yeah. In one of the last few months' issues of Imprimis by Hillsdale College, there was an article by a fellow who worked with Ron Reagan on finding out how on earth
with the Soviet Union financing itself, knowing that Reagan knew intuitively that no communist society can be productive unless it parasitically lives off capital cash. And so he investigated it and found all kinds of ways the Russians were financing themselves through us, through investing, bond issues, and so forth. Well, then what he said in this article on Imprimis, he said, we need to do the same thing with China. China has to get cash from outside of itself. And it's getting it through, he says, a company building their missiles financed by bond money through U.S. investment ETFs and so on. So what are we doing about that, or what can we do?
Well, that is a great question. Kevin Freeman, who lives in this area, if you put Kevin Freeman, China, he's a friend. He is a master at this. He advises the Pentagon and other organizations in Washington. Kevin Freeman, you might put China, risk, and his website is there. And contact Kevin. But this is the problem. Our Wall Street guys, you know, are greedy. And wherever they have an opportunity to make a buck, they're going to do it. And that was a problem with a lot of our companies. They were so quick to move into China. Fine, we'll give you our technology. We just want your market. Well, that was foolish. It was greed-based. And unfortunately, China received a tremendous amount of technology through the process. It was interesting. Reagan had the attitude that we got to break the Soviet Union. We're gonna ratchet up our defense. We're gonna spend so much money that Russia's gonna try to stay up, and it's gonna break them. And then George Herbert Walker Bush started going in and out of Russia with some Wall Street guys. I think it was Goldman Sachs and some others that thought that there was a great opportunity. Then the ruble crashed. That was in, I think, 98, 99, if I had the years correct. But China, when you think about how much China produces for the United States, I mean, it is in so many areas, clothing, I mean, labels on almost all our clothes, I mean, products. And we're so worried about the effect that that would have in a lot of our corporations if we put too much, put too much pressure on China. The whole tariff thing could get out of control. They're trying to do business with China at the same time, not creating a situation that could be really dramatic to the U.S. stock market. I mean, look, every time they think they're going to got a deal cut, look what it does to the stock market. And then they say, no, it doesn't look like we're close. And it drops again. And in this whole process, Charles, it's a very convoluted relationship. Matter of fact, I even thought in 2015, I'm going to look at what China's GDP was at the time of 2000, at the time of the 9/11 terror events. In 2001, at the time of the 9/11 terror events, China's gross domestic product was $1 trillion. Ours was like, I think, 10 or 11 trillion at the time. So what we did is the United States overstimulated our economy in order to take, you know, because of the backlash of 9/11 was devastating to our economy. So the Wall Street got into subprime lending, got into a lot of risky lending. They started doing a lot of business with China. And now China's GDP is right up there almost near ours at 14, 15 trillion in 18 years. Look how much their economy gone from 1 trillion to 13, 14 trillion compared to where we were and where we are now. China has benefited so much by our overstimulation of our economy to offset the cost of 9/11. And in that process, they are in technology, they're in science, they're in computers. They bought the IBM think tanks, they're developing their own computers. This Huawei organization is a very significant threat. And you know, it's how do you do less damage to the United States at the same time while trying to punish China? And it's real risky. But Kevin Freeman really understands it. And, you know, he's very concerned that we could have another 2008, where a massive amount of Chinese money and possibly oil money is pulled out of the United States, causing another market collapse, which would be very costly. So I kind of answered around your question, but nonetheless, the relationship we have with China is very complicated. And when you put something off as long as we have with China or North Korea or anything else, the solutions are very complicated and difficult to implement.
Okay, we're going to rotate back, flip back and forth. Bob?
Bill, you didn't comment on the immigration or the building of the wall underneath Trump so far. And what do we expect for this next year underneath Trump as far as what immigration policies may change and what we're going to look at on more of the wall being built?
Well, the problem with, first of all, the Democrats don't want a wall. They're going to do everything to stop the wall. They have been able to receive some money, I think, from the Pentagon to help build part of the wall. And then you get the media down there showing guys climbing over the wall, the little bit that's been built. And then you're going to hear it's going to be, they might build up to 26 miles of wall. And then at the only part of the wall that's been built right now is a reconstruction or a redevelopment of the wall that's already been built. So in essence, I mean, part of the wall is just, I mean, it's inadequate. They've used some Israeli technology, which helps. I mean, it's a long border, as you know, here in Texas. And my dad's farm in Arizona is very close to the Mexican border, which is also a large border. New Mexico is a large border. California, it's very difficult. Another problem is any meaningful immigration policies are stopped by these liberal judges that the Democrats have put into place. It happens over and over again. Sanctuary cities. I mean, look at California. I mean, my gosh. But of course, most of these congressmen, if you started putting the immigrants, the illegal immigrants, in their neighborhoods, their attitude would change. And you feel at the same time for these poor, a lot of these people just want an opportunity to work, and many of them are hard workers. And we got thugs coming in, unfortunately, also through the drug cartels. But there's a lot of people that have been taken advantage of by the coyotes that make a lot of money bringing them to the border. Up until maybe, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, California companies, other companies were benefiting from this cheap labor. So companies were making lots of money off this labor. So the whole thing, once again, anything Washington does, it has unintended consequences. And the whole process is complicated. And it's hard to get things worked out. It's hard to solve. This is another one of those things where the can was kicked down the road, and we're at a point of a lot of complexity now. And Trump, every time they try to do something with illegal immigration, these liberal judges appointed by Clinton or Obama stop it. So what's going to happen with the wall? I don't know. 26 miles, I think that's what they were hoping for, or what I saw the other day in the article. I didn't read it, but it's a complicated mess. Hopefully they can do something.
Well, I have heard that 7 straight months illegal immigration in 7 straight months.
Yeah, I think that's probably accurate.
And it's had
Mexico's
some...
Mexico's helping a bit because Trump threatened to start doing some things with tariffs and otherwise, and Mexico started stepping up and helping. But some of these cartels, you know, a couple weeks ago, I mean, these with that Mormon couple and that slaughter, You know, President Trump was thinking about classifying these cartels as terrorist organizations, and Mexico kind of was offended by that, so they haven't yet. But once again, it's another one of those complicated situations. It's because the drugs that come in from Mexico, the fentanyl, the opiates, it's tragic. And Trump's seen it firsthand when he goes to these small communities around the country that have been decimated by drugs that have come in from Mexico. Not just Mexico, but one of the countries.
Okay.
Earlier, when you were listing the Muslim countries that you have described as in a coalition against Israel, you included Syria in that group, especially among other theocratic Muslim countries, namely Iran, which I don't believe is an entirely apt comparison. Syria is exceptionally secular when compared to these countries, if not outright friendly towards believers. You can put up a Christmas tree in Syria. You can't do that in Iran. You can put up a cross in Syria. You cannot do that in Iran. And that is because of Bashar al-Assad, who is a more secular leader when compared to these other Muslims.
That's right.
When you look at his personal faith as an Alawite, which is a very unusual branch of Islam, where
kind of a quasi-Shia.
They almost seem to have either inherited or somehow adopted even certain Christian customs. They have a vague belief in the Trinity. They even practice communion. They're very secretive about it, however. The times when I was most upset with President Trump was when he bombed Syria in April, towards the tail end of his first 100 days in office, and then when he did it as well a year afterwards, because I don't think this is a country that we need to be antagonizing on the same level as Iran, which is time and again proven itself to be an active
threat. Let me hit on this. A couple things. First of all, you're right. It was interesting. I have a friend. He's the head Washington correspondent for Al Arabiya. And I said to a peer right after the whole situation started in Syria, you know, how long will Assad be able to stay in office? A couple of weeks, a couple of months, like Mubarak? He said, they're not going to get rid of him. I said, Pierre, you got to be kidding me. I mean, look what's happened to Mubarak. Look what's happened in these other countries. He said, he's got, because of the Alawites, which is about 10% of the country, they control the military, the police, they're very influential. He said, because of the apparatus that he has in place in the Syrian army, which also is very close to Iran, he said, I don't see him overthrown. I mean, here we are, what, 9-10 years later, and he's still in power. I've talked to Christian Syrians that have had to leave. And it was kind of like what happened in Iraq. The Christians had more freedoms under Saddam Hussein than they do now. Same thing in Syria. The Christians had more freedom under Assad than they do now. The other thing, and I've heard that part of the war in Syria, the civil war, started because Turkey started reducing the amount of water that they were giving Syria, that started playing into a lot of dissatisfaction in the country. And unfortunately, Russia and China kept stopping every meaningful UN resolutions at the UN to from the France, the UK, and the United States, permanent members of the UN Resolution Council, the five. And so nothing ever got done. And we've had, what, 500,000 to 700,000 people that have been killed. You have a dislocation of millions, 5, 6, 7 million people. And now Erdogan in Turkey is using that as a weapon, telling the EU, I want you to do what I tell you to do, otherwise I'm going to let 1 million or 2 million or 3 million immigrants into your country. So it's so complicated. The thing with the Patriot missiles that were fired into Syria, that was about the chemical weapons. And that was, you know, Obama gave a red line, he never did anything. And so Trump was basically saying, don't do the chemicals. And if you do, then we're gonna do something about it. So that's, you know, General Petraeus said that Syria is the most complicated military front in the world. And he would know. It's so complicated because the tribal factions, the Kurds, the Turks, the Syrians, the Russians, the Iranians, and the U.S. are all in there. So it's, you know, it's one of those things. We're waiting for Damascus 17-1, the day that Damascus will no longer exist as a city. And we're continuing to move it that way because Iran keeps popping weapons into Damascus. So the whole situation is very prophetic and biblical. Sound like you have a good understanding of what's going on there. And I feel for the Syrian Christians that have had to literally bail out of the country because of that civil war there.
I suppose what my question was, to wrap it up quickly, is how do you rationalize or justify President Trump's behavior when it's one of the only things that he's really done a 180 on during his campaign, where he was extremely anti-interventionist on the Syria question, and now he has bombed them twice? I know that you mentioned the gas attacks, but I also recall, I believe it was Mattis who later said that they could not prove that that second one was even a factory that was
I could see your concern. President Trump gets an intelligence report every single day from the CIA. They risk assess the greatest threats to the United States. Obviously, there's a lot, when Assad was all but defeated in 2015, summer of 2015, Russia showed up. And when Russia showed up, Assad turned the corner, and he's still in power because of Russia. So it's a complicated situation. With prophetic players aligning that will eventually align and become the coalition of Ezekiel 38 and 39 countries. So there's some things that we aren't privy of that President Trump is seeing and doing. We weren't real happy when he says we're out of Syria quickly. And the PKK, we're unhappy about it. But it's a very complicated place. A president has to make some very difficult decisions. And based on what General Petraeus said, that's one of the most difficult places in the world to contend with. ISIS was another concern. I mean, they were controlling a large part of Syria at that time, too. So I don't have the answer. I don't know why he did what he did. But I can tell you he knows a lot more about what's going on in Syria than we do, because he gets daily briefings on that stuff.
Has Trump been the least militant president that we've had in decades?
Well, I would say so. I mean,
yeah, I know.
What he does is it does sanctions. He doesn't,
right.
The couple times this gentleman was talking about, the couple times he put cruise missiles into Iraq, I mean, excuse me, Syria, was for a purpose.
Yeah.
But I agree. I mean, but I tell you what, my friend with Ali Arabiya said, Bill, I never thought I'd see a day where the Arab leaders would love Trump, but they love him. They're a little concerned now because of what he did with the Kurds, but they really like Trump because he's tough. And he says they operate in a business world, but they really appreciate it. He said, I never thought I would see it where they would like Trump as much as they do, most of the Middle East leaders. They're a little concerned right now about his commitment to the Middle East. But this is probably 18 months ago when he told me that.
So where do you see the election in Israel playing out? And also about this new non-aggression pact that they're trying to make with neighboring countries.
Isn't it amazing? Look at the political chaos, as I mentioned, between in the United States and in the UK and Israel. We don't know. You don't know who the new government's going to be in the UK, or if you can get anything accomplished.
Question: if I had a third one.
Well, what's interesting about the UK, that has to do with the Brexit as much as anything, the exit from the EU. Israel, I'll try to summarize it in a paragraph. The last two elections, Netanyahu's picked up around, I think, 34, 35. The Blue and White Party around 32, 33. The right-wing coalition comes to about 55. The blue and white can't come up with a 61. They need that to have a majority in the Knesset. But Lieberman, unfortunately, is the kingmaker, as they call him, refuses to be in a political party that includes the Orthodox Jews. And Netanyahu says, that's my right wing. I'm not gonna leave him. And Lieberman has a problem with the Orthodox Jews' control over the fact they don't want to be in the military, over marriage. The Blue and White Party is very secular. the gospel people, Christians, have a lot better time when the Orthodox Jews are not in charge of a couple departments inside Israel. A friend of mine, a Jewish evangelist, said that when Olmert and Livni were there, we had a lot more flexibility in Israel. And, when the Shahs took over the religious department, it got really tough for some of the Christian organization. Even had to send some people home within a week or 2 week notice. So the bottom line, it's Netanyahu's right-wing Orthodox party has not been too favorable. Netanyahu is very favorable to Christians. But with that said, we could have a third election. They thought there would be some people that were disgruntled by the first election, but they pretty much came out the same way in the second election. The question is, will the third election produce the same results? And if it does, it could go to a fourth election. Because the Lieberman's 8 or 9 members of his coalition refused to be part of the coalition. They've tried everything. And then Netanyahu being under indictment complicates things. So anyhow, only God, the God of Israel, knows who, but I couldn't even venture to guess.
Okay, thanks. Two things. First of all, I wanted to thank you for your service to the country and also to the Christian community and being a watchman on the wall.
Thank you very much.
My question, the Trump administration has used sanctions as a kind of a major strategy. I guess the question I have is this something new that others haven't done, or is he just doing it more? Kind of, how does it work? What's the downside, and is there a diminishing return to sanctions?
Boy, that's a good question. I guess it depends on where what the sanctions are. When you sanction Russia, you're concerned about some type of serious conflict with them, that one day they'll respond and do something, maybe militarily. Or I know their cyber attack people have been trying to cyber attack us, Chinese, North Koreans, Iranians, or they're probably the top four. They're constantly attempting to cyber attack Pentagon, White House. That's a problem with the sanctions. We've never had a government that has been so sanction-oriented as this one. In a lot of ways, I'm kind of surprised he hadn't been challenged more. But, what's interesting, the Republican Party seizes popularity, and they're concerned really to oppose anything Trump does. Trump will sanction anything and anybody at any time. We've never seen anybody do it quite like him. To a certain extent, it's been effective. With Iran, it's been effective. You got banks and companies that do not want to do any business with Iran, even to the point that China says, we don't want to do anything right now because we don't want to be sanctioned. We don't want to affect our banks, our companies. They've taken the Iran sanctions real serious, and it's been very effective through close cooperation with the U.S. Treasury Department. They are really watching this. The sanctions on the sanction threats with the EU has brought them to the table to talk about some of the imbalances. Trump sees how much money we spend to defend Europe through our German base or our Asia through our South Korean facilities and Guam and others. So he says, this needs to be a more level playing field, just like when he took on NATO. That was pretty powerful. And despite his style of doing things, the head of NATO, the Secretary General, is very appreciative of Trump because the countries are becoming stronger. They're still weak, but they're becoming stronger. So I guess the bottom line, depends on where the sanctions are. Iran, they've been effective. China, they brought them to the table. The people here in America have had to pay the price, especially the Midwestern farmers and some other companies have been affected. But the farmers are very loyal. They say, we'll hang in there as long as we can. And, hopefully one day this will improve. I guess USMCA is finally going to get approved, which will help farmers in Mexico and Canada. I don't know. We've never seen anything quite like this sanction movement. But we'll still see. The school's still not out. I just say right now the Iranian sanctions have been the most effective. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Rob Cooper. I'm a professor with Liberty University School of Government. And I've got two questions, if you can. The first question has to do with the fact you've talked about Pence, Pompeo, Bolton, and some of our servant leaders up in D.C. President Trump can appoint or should appoint about 5,000 different political appointees throughout the federal government. I can understand why there's an emphasis on the judges because of the lifetime appointments. But has there been any movement getting some of the evangelicals and others that have a biblical frame of reference into positions in the government to change the culture or to drain that swamp?
Boy, that's a good question. I would say, first of all, it is so hard to get certain people through the Senate. I mean, it's quite an effort. I mean, it's been masterful. McConnell and Chuck Grassley did a great job of getting a lot of judges through. Now Lindsey Graham is doing a good job, and McConnell, they're getting them through. But they do everything they can to slow things down, put things off the calendar. Fortunately, Republicans are in a majority in the Senate. But I mean, if it wasn't for that, I mean, we'd have a lot that wouldn't be in place. The other issue, which some of us kind of wonder sometimes, is the turnover. President Trump has had a lot of turnover, a lot more than other administrations. Part of it's because of difficulty of working for him. Part of it is, they just are tired of the pressure and stress and tension of being constantly surveilled by the U.S. press. So that's a challenge. He also is going to try to downsize the government, so he thought this might be a good opportunity to downsize. Some people say, we just wish he'd have pushed more people through in other cabinets or other divisions of our government, whether it's in commerce and in all these different parts of our government, that they would push more people through. There's a lot of obstructionists in Congress. So wherever they are and whenever they can, they do everything they can to, if they can't completely stop it, slow down the process, which leads to inefficiencies. The danger there leaves former Obama appointees in place that become the whistleblowers that thought they heard something or overheard something, and they're also the leakers. So it's just been a complicated 2.5-3 years, and the greatest concern of the media now is 4 more years of Trump. But the funny thing about it is they've made a lot of money because a lot of these news organizations, these anti-Trump news organizations, are making a lot of money because of Trump. They wouldn't have been otherwise.
All right. And this kind of leads into my second question. From what I can remember, when Reagan was president, the media and the Democrats, they were against him, but they were against George Bush. But since Trump took office, I mean, it's off the chart.
Whole different level.
Yeah. And so with media, with academia, with the Democratic Party, that's a lot of forces. That requires a lot of organization for such a concentrated effort. And I'm curious, who's driving the train?
Well, friends of mine that were there at the White House during Reagan's time, they said, they were always at him. And then George Herbert Walker Bush, same thing, at him. George W., I saw it firsthand. Every day it was about Iraq and the mistake of going in there, and that's debatable at this point, but it's hindsight. But nonetheless, they were after him, anything they could to disqualify him. And, Trump, they hate him. They've taken it to a whole different level. See, part of it, too, is they're protecting their turf. Illegal immigration, global warming. You hear, we've got 12 years to put everything in order. LGBT, same-sex marriage. Don't ask, don't tell. Is he going to get rid of this? Abortion. I mean, this guy's pro-life. So these sin things that unfortunately become the platform of the Democratic Party, they feel threatened by a conservative. And they feel threatened by someone that might take some of that turf away that they've worked hard for. And then, unfortunately, I mean, I see it. We have no chance against this media. 90 to 95% of the media is totally liberal. And anytime you have 91 to 95% of the news about the president that's negative, we don't have a chance. And what happened is our side is turning it off because we're getting fed up with it. Their side is becoming more toxic. And they continue to observe and watch and form their own opinions. I mean, there's people that you can't even talk to now that think Trump's the worst thing that ever lived. I mean, he's got his issues. There's no doubt about that. But nonetheless, he is, God put him in there, and he's doing some great things for Israel. He's doing some great things for a country that we hardly ever read about, unless you have a conservative news source that provides that. So,
but you don't see any kind of a singular organization, singular source, or leadership exerting more influence on this anti-Trump. And let me just get it for the record. I'm not anti-Democrat, but it would be an anti-Democratic party.
You mean anybody that's a Republic, a conservative force that could...
No. So I was talking... So the first question had to be changing the culture in D.C.
Oh, my. That culture is so gone. I mean, you can't believe it until you move there.
Well, be there. I spent 11 years with the Department of Defense Inspector General.
Okay. Well, yeah, good idea.
Partnership, yeah.
Defense and Pentagon's better, though. That's one of the few areas of our government that the public still appreciates. Yeah. It probably has the greatest approval rating.
Right. So I appreciate my time there. I did get to see a lot, but here and there, I mean, there are pockets, and I was just curious if any of those have been able to take advantage of. That was really the first question. The second question had to do with the anti-Trump bias between the media, between academia, between the Democratic Party. Let me just.
The other side is so entrenched. I mean, they're entrenched, and they're more motivated to continue their agenda than we are.
Okay.
You know, when you look at the behavior, I mean, there were a lot of us that were very disappointed that Obama became president, but we were civil, and we didn't act like this. You can't have a conservative voice speak on many college campuses in America without having either one being having their life threatened, that or having to cancel at the last minute because the school says we just can't risk having you speak on our campus. You know, the Tea Party movement kind of was a movement. It was done with a lot of believers, but it also was very effective, but it wasn't disorderly. We have the other side is disorder. There's some things that Trump does that just exactly what stirs him up more, and he kind of does that on purpose sometimes, but other times he doesn't. But nonetheless, they get really stirred up. And first of all, they aren't as civil as the conservatives. And secondly, they're entrenched, and this is their protection of their turf that they've committed many, many, many years in protecting. And some of our Christian activists over the last 10, 20 years, the Family Research Council, Jim Dobson, American Family Radio, the late gentleman here in Dallas, think of him in a second, Kirby Anderson's show, I'll think of it. But anyhow...
used to be with Marlon Maddox.
Yeah, Marlon Maddox. Look at with Marlon. Marlon was one of the first guys that was really on the front line. And we did a good job. And we fought them toe-to-toe. But unfortunately, there's more of them than us. And they control the media. And then they start calling us bigots and hate speech. You know, and then Obama came in with his civil rights agenda. He says our purpose is to have civil rights above religious rights. And the Civil Rights Commission was filled with his people. And the day that Obama's getting sworn in at the White House, his LBG agenda is put on the White House website. It was hideous. They had him watered down. It was so bad. So they're just much more motivated than we are. And unfortunately, they're so entrenched. I don't see how, unless we go through a major shaking in this country, I don't see how it will ever, ever change. And unfortunately, it seems to be getting worse.
Rush
Limbaugh?
Yeah. He's the other side.
Well, Rush, here's what's interesting about the conservative talk show guys, the Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham. Conservative talk radio does well because they have the opportunity to explain a position. The Democrats love TV because they're sound bites. So they can come in there and appeal to your emotions and make the conservatives look like bad guys because of their policies that they don't know much about, but they appeal to the emotion. Where conservative, for the most part, liberal talk radio fails. They're failed because they can't defend their position. So that's part of another media challenge that we're facing.
Yeah, I was hoping you could maybe shed some light or give your perspective on an issue I think is extremely important, and we don't seem to hear a lot about it. The possibility or the future of oil being denominated in dollars or some other currency, how that relates to Saudi Arabia and the United States?
Well, that's been a benefit that we've had for a long time, that oil's traded in dollars. And I know the Russians are and Iranians and Chinese are talking about moving it off the dollar onto other currencies, and that's a concern. That's been a lot of leverage that we've had. With some of the sanctions, there's a possibility that Russia might work directly with Iran, but there's talk of taking them out of the SWIFT program, the money transfer program. And if they get pulled out of SWIFT, they said, you know, that's terrorism. So that money still has to be transferred. I'm not savvy in that area, but I read something this week that Russia's threatening us if somehow or another we sanction them where they can't use SWIFT to transfer money. But Russia's talking to Iran right now, and I think even India and Iran are talking, the BRICS group, Brazil included, but especially India, talking about eventually transacting money in their currencies with some of the oil producers. I think that could be problematic for the United States. Yes?
Don't you think that Trump's presidency, even if it's two terms, is obviously going to cause such whiplash by the other side?
Well, you know, Tommy, at some point they're going to do something. They haven't really struck us yet. And obviously our concern always is militarily.
No, I'm talking about in the United States, the left whiplash, if they ever get control again before the rapture.
Oh my. We don't want to see.
Right.
You know, I'm worried right now in Virginia where all of a sudden we got a blue state where our legislature is all blue. I mean, they're all liberals and our governor is. I'm real concerned about what they're going to push through a former red state that's gradually gotten to the point of being a blue state. I mean, both House and Senate in Virginia now are liberal, and we got a liberal governor. I just, you know, and if that happens to our U.S. government, oh my.
Ralph Northam.
What's that?
Ralph Northam. yeah, okay.
Hello, Bill. It's always good to see you. We appreciate your presentations. I've got a comment, and then I've got a question for you. My pastor is Robert Jeffress. One of the first things he did when he came 11 years ago was start what he calls Pastor's Prayer Partners. Right now we have over 350 men whose purpose is to pray as closely as we can, 24 hours a day, for him, for President. We often meet with him before the first service. And last Sunday, he said, last Friday, my wife and I were at the White House for a Christmas party. And he said we were waiting the president. The president came in the room, pointed to me and said, "There's my pastor." And then he said, "Pastor, I got a question for you. Nancy Pelosi says she prays for me every day. Now, I don't believe that. What do you say?" We're asking, "What do you say? What do you say?" And he said, "Well, at the end of the meal, when we were getting ready to go, Secret Service man came and said, the president wants you and your wife, Amy, to come to the Oval Office." So he comes in the Oval Office. There's the president sitting at his desk. There's Mike Pompeo. And then there's,
Mike Pence or?
Newt Gingrich. And then there were a couple of people on the couch, and he said, "Get up," so they can sit. And so the pastor said, "Mr. President, you asked me earlier what I thought about Nancy Pelosi." He said, I can't say anything about that, but I can guarantee you one thing, and that's that we have millions of Christians praying for you every day." And then sometime in the evening, it was mentioned, the president was asked about impeachment. And he said, I don't care about that, but it's really hard on my family.
Yeah.
Now, my question is, when I first heard about the president pulling us out of Syria, northern Syria, I commented to my wife, "What are they covering? not long after, we got that wonderful, renowned religious scholar, al-Baghdadi. Were they covering this? Maybe give him a sense, a false sense of security. You have any sense that that was...
What about Baghdadi? That there were...
That the announcement of the pullout of our forces in northern Syria, that was used to cover our actions to get Baghdadi?
Oh, I think the timing was interesting. I don't know if there's any parallel. What was interesting is the week that Barack Obama's birth certificate became like big news, even some of the major networks were starting to pick up on it, because what was being done about the fact that that birth certificate was fake, false, the major networks, CBS and a few others, were starting to go in that direction. And what happened? 48 hours later, bin Laden was captured. And it just took all that birth certificate stuff completely out of the news and never heard about it again. I think was that God's supernatural way of catching Baghdadi at that time, where it was the right time? Or was it something to kind of diffuse some of the... And Baghdadi's number two guy got knocked out just shortly thereafter. So was that God's timing, or was there a plan to help defuse it? I do know a lot of people went to the White House right after this decision to move out of Syria happened. A lot of people, Franklin Graham spoke, he spoke, I don't know if he's at the White House, other people were at the White House saying, you can't do this to these people. And President Trump was surprised by the backlash, more than he thought about. It also came out that, why are you doing anything to give Erdogan credit as being a great leader? He's a thug. Anyway, obviously he hears this stuff from the CIA briefings he gets every day. And then it came out that Trump has two high-rise condominiums in Istanbul that he owns or partnered in. And go, that's interesting. That always has to be something to everything. But nonetheless, that was a surprise. We still have troops there. We pretty much told everybody, back off. Vice President Pence was in Erbil the other day with the Kurd leaders, the Peshmerga side. We're doing what we can to provide money for them. I read yesterday where some of the oil that we've got control of in northeast Syria is going to help the Kurds. So we're doing what we can to kind of backtrack and help them out. But we could not have done what we did with ISIS, the United States / a few people with NATO, without those Kurds, those PKK Kurds. We couldn't have done it. They're incredible fighters. So, again, this is a tough region. It's always complicated, and it's never easy, your decisions, and there's always consequences.
Bill, could you please comment on the Democratic primary, presidential primary?
Wow. There's really a weak bench. I mentioned earlier, it's a weak bench. Biden, when he decided to run for president, I said, his mouth will take him out. he'll never be the guy. I just can't see it. And now all this stuff that's come out about Ukraine and his favor with his son, Hunter, and all these other things, all this other favor that the family's benefited from his time in office, it's going to surface. I mean, if they impeach Trump and it gets to the Senate, Hunter Biden's going to be one of the first guys called in there to testify. And Joe Biden will probably be also asked. Oh, it's going to get, these guys are not dummies. Ted Cruz, all these guys, Lindsey Graham, these are smart guys, and they're fed up with this whole process, just like Bill Barr and a few others. So it's not going to get pretty. Michael Bloomberg has got tons of money, but I don't think he can buy it. Very liberal, take the guns, pro-gay, pro all these things. He's built a remarkable company. Got to give him credit there. But I don't think he can do it. The rumor now is Hillary looks good in the polls, but things will come out about Hillary and Ukraine and Uranium 101 and these emails that got a lot of, I think there's other ways to the Hillary, and I think that's just more, she hasn't had much attention lately, so I think that's really what motivates.
What about Obama's wife?
Hey, that's always, she didn't want to go back to, she could be difficult. She's a popular person. I don't think she wants the job, Tommy, but she would be formidable. But I don't.
What about Oprah?
It'd be a pay grade loss, but I don't think Oprah would be a. She'd rather fund them than be the president.
I want to thank you because you introduced my next question. So here we go. The Horowitz report just came out, and I find it interesting that Durham and Barr have both been a little bit critical of it because they kind of say it doesn't go quite far enough. I'm from Salt Lake City. Horowitz is from Salt Lake City.
Right.
Do you know if he's LDS?
I don't.
Because if that is the case, LDS people have a very strong tendency to be self-righteous. And that would play into the way he reported this.
Interesting. Interesting. I haven't. I don't. You know, there's Jews that are Horowitz. So when I heard, I don't know if he's Jewish or Mormon, but
right.
There's some people pretty furious. He didn't go far enough, deep enough, and for Durham to come out so quickly, honoring what he was trying to do, just says there's a lot more to this, and it's going to come out. And we just got to keep praying for John Durham and also Bill Barr that nothing gets in the way of the truth of this being exposed. And I have a friend that knows Giuliani. Giuliani's got a lot more on this. He has to be a little bit more careful in his interviews and TV. But nonetheless, Giuliani's got a lot. I mean, he's not a fool. So I just think, the Republicans have been, it's like one of the top writers from New York Post said, Trump's clever, clever like a fox, So I think the Republicans just have been accumulating for the last 3 years content, information, and every time something starts surfacing, the Democrats get more offensive, trying to stop. I mean, their aggressiveness in some ways is trying to keep some of this stuff off the front page of the newspapers, which would be if the Trump focus wasn't on them. They got a lot of stuff. I hope they use it when they need to, but I think they're going to do it, I would say, next year, right before the election, probably the most opportune time, unfortunately.
One other comment, and that is, being from Utah as I am, Republicans are extremely disappointed in Mitt Romney.
I was just going to ask that.
In fact, before he was ever elected, I'm involved in the Republican Party, and the debate came up, is he part of the swamp? And he's answered that question.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think he can be trusted. I mean, his first interview in Washington, D.C. after being elected senator was with the Washington Post and CNN. I mean, outside the New York Times, they hate Trump more than anybody, and he goes and has interviews and talks about civility. He's positioning himself to be the candidate in 2020. I don't want to ever stay home for election, but I could never vote for him after some of the things he's tried to pull off. And also thrown in he blew the chance that he had. I know God has his timing for everything, but he really technically blew his chance of becoming the president just by doing some bad moves. He was very aggressive in his first debate with Obama, but the last two, he was terrible.
He's a fake Republican.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're right. Yeah.
So last week, the Washington Post, or really this week, came out with a report that investigated a lot of what's gone on in Afghanistan and found routinely that the military personnel had overstated goals that were achieved. And it's been a 20-year war that three presidents have been wanting to get us out of. Just what's the reaction from you and from D.C. in total? And then I have
the only good thing about the Iraqi war is it moves things down the line prophetically. That's what it's done. It's moved things. The Iraqi war led to Obama being elected, led to the Iran nuke deal, which led to Trump, being a great supporter of Israel. So you look at how everything falls into place. Our American presidents have had such a significant prophetic role when it comes to Israel and the Middle East. All the way back to Truman. But I think the thing here is George Bush was convinced, and Dick Cheney as well, that by some ex-Iraqi expatriates that they will be throwing rose petals at your feet. The Iraqi people will be throwing rose petals at your feet when you take down Saddam Hussein. They will honor you. And then this idea that you're going to democratize Arab countries. Oh, my gosh. Who convinced them of that? That is crazy. And then, you know, speaking of God's timing for everything, Schwarzkopf was ready to go in and take Saddam down during Desert Storm. But Colin Powell told President Bush this would be a mistake, don't do it, and lobbied hard. Cheney lobbied hard to take him down. Cheney agreed with Schwarzkopf, and they had a big meeting in the Oval Office. Powell and Cheney left, and Powell circled back around and came back into the Oval Office and convinced President Bush not to go in and take Saddam down during the Desert Storm. So what happens 8 years later, Vice President Cheney once again is in that position. We got to take down Saddam. And he convinced Bush, and Bush went along with it. And unfortunately, they pretty much took down the Iraqi army, too, and then Iran just scooted right in. The Iraqi army cannot fight the Iranians, and now, unfortunately, the Iraqi army is pro-Iran. So it's all prophetic. Everything falls into place. Afghanistan, same thing. Mistake. Look, we spent $6 trillion. I mean, just think of the money that we've spent.
And people.
The 6,000-7,000 people that lost their life. That's small, tragic. It's too bad. But think of our other wars. Vietnam, Korea, World War One. We lost tens of thousands of men and women. But so with all that said, this is prophetic fulfillment. Mistakes made by our leaders have brought us to the point that we have an American president that very possibly might be put in a position to have to make a decision about Iran. And he might have to because of his great support of Israel. So I don't know. It's just everything's kind of falling into place prophetically despite the mistakes.
And what do you think of the effort, and I should know the name of this, but it's just Christian pastors signing up on a really full agenda of things, and I think it's not called Common Grounds, which I thought was, I'm slipping the name, but Common for 2000 or something like that, and it has things that address gun control in such a way that the right to bear arms exists, but not military-grade weapons, and I think there's 30 points. And maybe the broader question is just, how does the church get involved in setting the agenda and making things happen? I think we sit back and complain, but what would be, or who is already doing good things to move the ball forward in a Christ-like manner, if I can say it that way?
Well, you know, we have, you know, unfortunately, as you all know, here in America, I mean, our faith community is pretty, it's in a bad shape. I mean, I watched over the last 12 to 15 years, the Protestants and Catholic position on homosexuality, marriage, same-sex marriage, to the point now we have 57% of Catholics in favor of same-sex marriage and 63% of Protestants in favor of same-sex marriage. The evangelicals were at 20% now. I think it's up to 23% favor. That, you know, the evangelicals, I mean, we're the Genesis to Revelation guys. Unfortunately, the liberal part of the church is becoming, they're looking to all kinds of solutions. What's interesting is the liberal part of the church is really into social justice. But what's interesting, the same the social justice part of the liberal church is also the 65% of our American church is also replacement theology. I added that up in 2004. We have 100 million church attendees in America that are going to replacement theology churches. And they're the ones the Vatican is honored. They're calling Israel to leave the occupied land. They're the ones that have honored Palestine. They have a relationship with the Palestinians because a lot of Palestinian Arabs are now part of the Catholic, they're Catholic bishops. So we have a lot of challenges here in America. I mean, I'm hearing people on TV call themselves Christians that are in favor of same-sex marriage. You know, the five on Fox. I mean, all of, there's a couple of people that call themselves believers. They're all in favor of same-sex marriage. You know, you see Christians that write for USA Today and other newspapers say they favor same-sex marriage, LGBT. So, I mean, it's just, if we don't get back, as mentioned to Dr. Kaiser today, I think Ed Heinsohn as well, if we don't get back to the biblical foundation and stick with the Word of God for what it says about all these things, I mean, we're doomed. Unfortunately, we're reaping the consequences right now of where the church is. And I mean, and George Barna says 1% of the millennials today have a biblical worldview. Well, why'd that happen? They didn't get it at home. They didn't go get it in church. So, unfortunately, I mean, how does God get America's attention? Well, He can drive us to our knees. 9/11 almost did. 77 out of 10 Americans were depressed after 9/11. They flock back into the church, only leave shortly thereafter. We have less people attending to church today than at the time of 9/11. So, I don't know. How's God going to get America's attention? I don't know. That, or He just takes us home.
I got a suggestion.
Yeah.
The rapture.
But absolutely. I mean, that would be the quickest, cleanest, easiest for us. But it would. I mean, America will be a third world great power. It'd take 30 million born-again believers, maybe more than that, or true Christians. America would come to its knees instantaneously after the rapture. And then also the final aliyah to Israel, the Jewish people who look to us now as their support, they would be out of here so fast,
right,
because the evangelicals are gone.
That was just a suggestion.
That's a great one. Another one for us to pray about, Tommy. That's a
well. Thanks for your report and for these comments. I just want to add one thing with America being on the reserve currency, somewhat in the domain of what I do. The problem with sanctions is we need to legally enforce those. When we legally enforce protection of our currency is what it would come down to, which could turn in isolating us, and that the dollar would no longer be the reserve currency. And as you've mentioned, that has humongo benefits for us, that we're able to borrow at incredibly low rates, and it goes on and on and on. So to the point where Russia and Iran recently were still trading in dollars, that everyone else has to do world trade in dollars. And as these countries peel off, and China reducing our debt, which we don't have quite as much as the news seems to indicate, or they don't, and going more into euros, this is going to be a big change for us. So
yeah, that's very interesting. You know, it's interesting, December 17th, 2014, is the day the EU Parliament voted overwhelmingly in favor of the concept of a Palestinian state. That's the day the euro collapsed. Went from 125 to the dollar down to a dime. I mean, it went in a dime. Just like that. Thanks.
Bill, we've got a multi-billionaire in this world that's anti-Semitic towards Israel, that's anti-American, that, and you already know where I'm going with this, I guess. And I've seen reports of how much companies in the United States that he owns or has controlling interest in, and a lot of it is the news media. What's your opinion on George Soros?
Oh, you know, people that I know have been looking to him as the Antichrist for 20 years. I mean, George Soros is a type and shadow of an Antichrist. Not it. I think they all have characteristics. Some of them, Obama, Tony Blair, others that are charismatic leaders that have influence. Soros is, he helps fund the right-wing watch that goes after every Christian that says things biblically. I was at the Mandarin Oriental 2 days ago for a meeting, and 72 hours after Trump got elected, Soros had some of the wealthiest Democratic funders in America at the Orient Hotel for 3 days of meetings of how do we counter this Trump. They were absolute shocked, but he had everybody at the Orient, these big dollar guys, doing everything they can. Soros is bad news. His hand, he is all over the world, you know. He has a lot of influence. I won't go into a lot of detail, but there is so much on him from credible news sources that he has a lot of influence. He has billions and billions, and he's using it. Open Society and all these subgroups, the Podestas work for him, do things for him. There's organizations. I think there's probably some things on the Internet to show all the organizations that he's part of or helps fund. And he's dangerous, and he has a bad history.
Thank you.
real quick, what do you think about the election coming up?
Well, Tommy, I...
do you think in some of these states, like in the upper Midwest, it'll be an honest election, or,
I think they will. A lot of times, we have Republican lawyers in almost every precinct in America at the elections. They follow them pretty carefully.
But what about these, we found this box of votes that we forgot to count, you know?
Well, that can happen. California is the state that most concerned. Look at conservative Orange County, California is now, I think, mostly blue.
Right. Yeah, they stole five elections.
Yeah,
in right. That last, they
yeah.
got
yeah.
rid of.
It's tough.
They stole five congressmen out of Orange County.
Yeah,
in the last
Orange
election.
County. I think, isn't it amazing? Well, you go, why are these elections so important? Well, because it's a sin agenda. We're fighting against the sin agenda. I mean, the fact that we have 12 more years to get the climate right, or we're going to be history. I mean, this is one of their rallying cries. I mean, you got Prince Charles, people that have some credibility. I mean, and others are saying we have 12 years to correct this. And this is, I mean, a lot of people believe this. They're uninformed. So that's a big deal. The LGBT agenda, the same-sex marriage, they are fighting for their agenda, and their agenda is evil, and this is a battle between good and evil.
Right.
That's why it's so ferocious right now, and we're at a point where there's no wiggle room. And we're trying to take our territory back, but once you lose this territory, it's hard to get it back, especially in the sin issue. So I think it's just going to continue to be divisive like this until something shakes America or the rapture for the rest of our life, Tommy. I mean, it's bad and it's deep. That Trump has helped expose a lot of this that wouldn't have been exposed otherwise.
Right.
Been another benefit.
Sure, if Hillary had won, we wouldn't know
we wouldn't
of any
have,
of this.
A lot of this we wouldn't know. And that's the thing I noticed when I was being at the White House when Obama was there. You know, press secretary, all the time would say half-truth and say truth just to captivate people, but never address the lie. Never address a lie. They're masters at hiding the lies. They're masters at hiding the falsehood. And that's what's difficult in dealing with this media is this stuff is getting out now because of Trump, and that's another benefit to having him in office. So with all that said, as I said tonight, my concern, 44 Republicans with a lot of history didn't run in 2018. 19 right now are not running again, 5 in Texas, and we got to continue to keep those seats and gain some. But Trump also has to be careful. And Ira Fleischer said this, and I agree, is he's got to go beyond his base because he needs independent votes. And if you keep saying things just to feed your base and forget about the independents, it's not going to be helpful. And he probably lost 4 to 7 seats in the last election because he didn't get the independents. A lot of those races were close, Dan, 100 votes, 1,000 votes. And he lost some independents that could have got us Republicans more seats.